During these last few golden days of summer, in the late afternoon, an insect orchestra starts to play, and they play deep into the night. This hour, Summer Insect Song. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here to tell us what kinds of insects are out there buzzing, chirping, and whirring. And we'll also find out why they're making all that noise. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions about the plants and insects you encounter. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Horticulturist Richard Geron will join us in a few minutes to answer your plant questions. But first, we're going to talk about the singing insects of summer with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Good morning, Donald.
Hello, Charity. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And we are finally having a little bit of normal summer.
We went through some cool temperatures that seemed to quiet the insects down, but now that the daytime temperatures are higher, and especially now that the nighttime temperatures are higher, the chorus outside in wooded areas and residential areas has just been spectacular.
And it tends to start in the late afternoon hours. What do we start hearing?
The first ones of the day, that kind of right after lunch, that early afternoon, that the ones that are singing at that time are mostly the annual cicadas. These are those large inch-long insects. They're kind of greenish with clear wings, kind of a black body. They're the ones that you find their shells stuck to the tree trunks. The cicadas leave their shells on the tree trunk when they emerge from the soil. They climb up. They shed their skin. They leave the old skin behind. They expand their wings. They move up into the tree. And as soon as they can, the males start chorusing. They start making the racket that we hear in sort of mid-afternoon.
And we do have a little bit of a sound of a scissor grinder cicada. And there are a lot of different kinds of cicadas.
Dozens and dozens. And they can be told apart by their songs. I'm not a good enough expert to tell all of them. But
if you're not good enough, Donald, I can't imagine who is.
But, but there are specialists who do this. And if you go to the internet and look up insect songs, well, number one, you get lots of songs that are about insects. But if you look up singing insects, you also get these audio clips of what these different species sound like.
All right. Well, let's listen to the scissor grinder. And I think that sounds familiar to a lot of us.
That's the one that I hear in my backyard and the one I hear throughout central Iowa, at least. There are different species in different areas. Of course, the name scissor grinder, you have to wonder, what were they thinking? Well, what they were thinking is back in the early 1900s when they were naming these insects, there must have been a craftsman that would sharpen your scissors for you, and he or she would hold them against the grindstone in this sort of rhythmic zzz fashion, and that name has stuck, even though I'm not sure we have scissor grinders as a profession anymore, but the name has stuck, and that's the one that is common.
And it's a really loud sound. What are the cicadas trying to accomplish by making this very loud noise?
Oh, it's as obvious as it seems. It's all about sex. The ones that are making the noise are the males. And in the case of the cicadas, the sound is made on a drum, a membrane, that's alongside the abdomen. And if you think about a canning jar lid, how when you push it down, it goes, and when you let up on it, it clicks up, and then you start going up and down, and it's click, 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 click. Well, that's what the cicada is doing with the drums on the side of his abdomen, except it's so fast you don't hear click, click, click. You hear zzz. And then the abdomen of the male is mostly hollow. Then they hold their wings at an angle that creates a megaphone. So everything is designed to maximize the clicks they are getting out of these little tiny drums on the sides of their abdomen, and the sound projects long and far, quite loud, and it's the equivalent of standing in the tidal pool in Washington, D.C. saying, hey, baby, hey, baby, hey, baby.
And then that works?
Well, apparently it does, because every year we have more cicadas, and we get more cicadas by the males and females finding each other, the females selecting the loudest buzzing cicada male in the tree. After they've mated, the female lays her eggs, and the species has been propagated.
So this is something they do in the afternoon. When do they start to quiet down?
I think it's right at dusk. It seems like it is just starting to get dark when they are giving up and their sound goes away and their place is taken by another species. So you hear sounds from mid-afternoon till very late at night, but it's two different kinds of insects. I think the cicadas quit at sundown.
All right. And then what do we start to hear?
Then it's those raucous katydids. And this is one that I have just enjoyed hearing, because it used to be unusual in my neighborhood to hear a katydid. They were in North Ames, but they weren't kind of in Central Ames. But the populations have just increased over the last decade or two. And now we have katydids pretty much throughout the city of Ames and large areas of Iowa as well. But katydids are the ones in the trees. The males, again, are rubbing their wings together to make the sound that is zit, 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 zit. And it sounds sort of like katydid, katydid, did, if you try to put words to it.
All right, well, let's listen to some sound of the true katydid.
That's a cold one.
Because it's going slower?
Because it's very slow.
Mm-hmm. And we had a katydid. Oh, now we're faster.
And that's a hot one. This is a much warmer temperature that the katydid male is scratching much, much faster.
We had a katydid come into our house a couple of years ago, and it woke us up in the middle of the night, and it almost sounded like our fire alarm because it was, again, so loud. They really can broadcast this message a long way.
Again, the katydids are rubbing their wings together, and on one wing is a little file. It's a little row of closely spaced ridges, and on the other wing is a little peg. And as the wings move over each other, one moves over the other, the peg is dragged across the file. And it's the equivalent of the sound you would get if you ran your thumbnail down the teeth of a comb. You know, this click, 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 click as your thumbnail runs down the teeth. That's what's happening with their wings. But again, they're holding their wings as a megaphone, and that sound carries for long distances with the hopes of luring in a female who will be impressed with the sound of the clicks made by my wings.
Now, there are a couple other noises that we hear in all of this in the evening hours. We also hear crickets, right?
We have field crickets, we have ground crickets, so there are several different crickets, and we also have tree crickets. Now, each one of those makes a slightly different sound, but in all of the crickets, again, it is the wings rubbing over each other. It's the peg being scratched across the file that creates the sound. The black field cricket is very common in the fall of the year. They are a common accidental invader that wander into the house. They disappear under the refrigerator. They're broadcasting their sound, and you can't figure out where it's coming from.
And you cannot get them to quiet down. And yeah. This is, again, only the males.
Only the males are able to sing. And I think the field cricket is maybe one of the better-known crickets. It's a rhythmic chirp, but it's fairly irregular. They don't have a nice, even pattern. It's a chirp now and, a little bit later, here's a chirp there. But then they get kind of excited, and there'll be a series of chirps in a row. But it's not rhythmic like the katydids were.
All right. And we actually have a little bit of tree cricket sound, because I think most of us know what the field crickets sound like. But here's tree crickets. And again, that sounds like a summer evening to me.
That's the background sound of summer. And if you were a movie maker and you wanted to convince the audience that the scene you're shooting is happening at night, then you would put that into the soundtrack of the movie, and subliminally you would say, it must be nighttime, even though it may not have been shot at night. They put that sound in there. That background sound is the kind of the sound of summer. If you're close enough to an individual of that tree cricket species, and you could sort of hear in the background the pulse, that's the one that's also known as the temperature cricket, where you count the clicks or you count the chirps in 15 seconds, and I think you multiply by 4, and it approximates the temperature. That doesn't work for every cricket. It just works for that one species of cricket.
Now, all of these crickets are calling for mates. Once they find a mate, do they stop or do they call for another?
I think they just keep calling.
All right.
It's a guy thing, Charity. they're always calling. And part of it as well is they are announcing to other males, I'm here, you shouldn't be. So there's kind of the competition, and it's the same reason the cardinals start singing really early in the morning, is the males are announcing their presence to other males that are nearby. They're hoping to announce their presence to other females that might be wandering through. And they're just going to keep doing it because that's what they're programmed to do.
And when do we stop hearing this chorus?
Well, one of the things that I have noticed getting up fairly early in the morning is the katydids will still be singing at 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning. So that started at sundown, and it continues to go on until the wee hours of the morning. The last katydid of the fall probably won't stop until November, and he will be a really cold, lonely guy, and that zit-zit-zit-zit that was very fast at high temperatures will be agonizingly slow as he cools down, and as the nighttime temperatures are cold, it'll be zit-zit-zit. And he's barely warm enough to keep rubbing his wings, but there he is, fighting to the end, still trying.
And what happens to him when he stops singing?
Well, what happens to all insects after their reproductive period is over? They die. Most insects have a very short post-reproductive life. Once they have fulfilled their biological destiny, once they have done their job to perpetuate the species, they move out of the way. The eggs and nymphs will make it through the winter. And they'll start up next year as immatures and grow up to be adults by late summer as well. So after mating and egg laying has taken place, most adult insects pass away.
And it'll be a slightly different chorus next year, depending on what cicadas emerge and the different mix of insects, right?
It'll be a little bit different, but it's always great. It's great to be out and hear it happening.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Right now with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Of course, he will answer your insect questions when we get back from the break. ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran will be here to answer your plant questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. ISU Extension horticulturist Richard Duran is also here now. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today, and of course, you can join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com. And we already have a couple of email questions. I'm sure you've been hearing this question a lot, Donald, but this is about the emerald ash borer from Marine in Iowa City. Is there a prophylactic treatment for the ash trees? What are the signs of an infestation? What actions should a homeowner be taking right now?
Well, I think the easy website to direct people to is just emeraldashborer.info. And that's a national website, so you'll see the distribution of the emerald ash borer as it exists around the country, including in the three counties, count them, only three counties in Iowa have reported the emerald ash borer. Treatment is something that can be done. It is moderately expensive if you have a large tree. Kind of an estimation, a rough estimation, is if you hug your tree and think about the diameter of the tree. How wide is the tree? And multiply that number of inches times $10 per inch. That's about what it should cost to treat that tree. Now, because it's expensive and because we're using insecticides, we try not to do it until we need to do it. And the recommendation of all the states that have emerald ash borer is to wait until emerald ash borer is confirmed within 15 miles of your healthy specimen ash tree that is worthy of protection, and then you begin the chemical treatment. Large trees need to be commercially treated, and you'll have to hire someone to come in and treat those larger trees. But at this point, in the towns of up in Alamakee County, over in Burlington, down in Fairfield, those are the only places emerald ash borer has been found in the state.
All right, so don't do anything right now, is what you're saying.
That would be our recommendation. Of course, there's a great profit motive to be made treating trees, so lots of people are recommending it or saying buy our chemicals, buy our service. But we think of it a lot like cancer treatments. You wouldn't treat for cancer until it was diagnosed, and we feel that way about emerald ash borer. We shouldn't be treating until it's diagnosed or at least very close to us.
All right. Next up, Jim is on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, I am in my early 60s, and the cicadas, of course, are very loud. And I just wanted to know if when I was a teenager or in my 20s, I still grew up in this area, and I don't remember them being real loud. I remember crickets, but I don't remember the cicadas. And I just wanted to know if they were there.
I think we've always had cicadas. I think the bigger change has been in katydids. And Richard and I were just commenting that 25 years ago, I could go to the north edge of Ames, kind of out in the woods, and I could hear katydids. And then it was, oh, it's a little farther south. And now katydids exist, at least to my knowledge, as far south as Main Street here in Ames. So there has been a change in the distribution of the population that I have observed in my lifetime living in my town. So I think there are these changes over time. It's kind of a slow, gradual change. So I've observed this difference in katydids, and it's certainly possible there's been a difference in cicadas. I'll have to say that as a kid, I remember collecting cicada shells, but I don't remember listening to the sound. So, you know, maybe I just wasn't paying enough attention. There were other things on my mind back then, but we've always had them. And as we mentioned, the name is old enough to indicate that they've been around a long, long time.
Now, of course, in, let's say, the 1960s, we were spraying a lot more pesticides around. Do you think that that may have created a quieter summer evening then?
Oh, I don't know that we're going to be able to document that trend. We could also say back in the 60s, we had a lot more diversity of landscape that we've taken out. Fence rows that used to hold trees, we've cleared woodlands that used to have a lot more trees where we would find cicadas and katydids. But then on the other hand, we've planted a lot more trees around our houses in urban areas. I doubt that there's one easy explanation to why we would observe these changes. I think things just come and go according to the vagaries of life rather than through easily identified causes.
John is on the line next in Knoxville. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I was wondering where we were with the 13-year cicadas. It seems to me like last time they were here, 13 years should have passed for the next wave of them. We found one of them this summer, and that's been the only one we found.
Right. The major brood of periodical cicadas, now we're talking about a different insect. These are the black ones with the bright red eyes and the orange wing veins, the ones that come every 13th or 17th year. The major ones in Iowa are 17-year cicadas, and they were last seen in central Iowa from Ledges State Park down the Des Moines River Valley all the way to the tip of the state, including Knoxville. They were last seen in 1997. So 2014 will be their emergence year. But there are always stragglers that are a little bit off schedule, so we can find one now and then. But the populations of 20,000 to 40,000 periodical cicadas per tree that we're going to hear next June will be unmistakable. So, John, your question is very timely. It'll be next June that we get the major emergence of the periodical cicada.
All right, John, thanks a lot for your call. And Jennifer's on the line next in Ames. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I had a question. I haven't seen any monarch butterflies this season, and I wondered if they were in trouble or if it's, you know, usually I'm watching caterpillars on the butterfly plants by now, and has anybody else observed that?
Certainly, Jennifer. We've all watched the decline of monarch populations, and I had this little celebratory dance just earlier this week because I saw one, and it was the one that I saw. A long series of events are really at a disadvantage for the monarch butterflies. Bad weather in Mexico, you know, they go to Mexico to overwinter. The overwintering sites have become tourist locations. Their overwintering sites are threatened because of environmental changes down there. Droughts in Texas have reduced the population of milkweeds that the monarchs depend upon in February and March. And then the monarchs get to Iowa, and they can't find any milkweeds because the milkweeds are killed by Roundup applied to Roundup-ready corn and soybeans. So we have eliminated pretty much through most of the state milkweeds that the monarchs depend upon. So there's this series of things that have all changed recently and put the monarch butterflies in jeopardy.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for your call, and you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Richard, we've got a plant question for you.
Okay.
All right, Tom is on the line in Coon Rapids. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
We have had probably a quarter of an inch of rain since the third or fourth week in June.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, when do we start watering, or do we need to be concerned about trees and shrubs and how to water those?
Right. I would say if they're well established, if they've been in the ground for at least 3 years, I think they should be okay. If you have something planted this year or last year, then I would be watering those, and I would water those about every week or 10 days.
Okay.
And I would just go out with a hose, and I would take off the nozzle, and I would turn it on slowly and go around the tree, maybe leaving it for maybe 5-10 minutes at a time. And go around the tree like 12, 3, 6, 9. And then maybe go out 2 more feet and do the same thing. And basically really soak it nice and deeply around the tree or shrub.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. What should we look for if a tree or shrub is starting to get under drought stress?
Right. If you start to see yellowing of leaves, we're starting to see that right now on certain trees in central Iowa.
Yes, we are.
For example, on birch, on linden. When they're dry, they show some symptoms. And so you'll see yellowing of leaves, some leaf drop. Sometimes they take on a kind of a off color where they were nice and green, but now they're kind of grayish green. So you can kind of tell if they're dry.
Okay, and that includes shrubs as well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot for your call. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Donald, here's another question I know you get a lot this time of year. This is from Dorothy. What are the large wasp-like insects with three yellow stripes across their backs that I see hovering outside?
They're the largest wasp we have in the state of Iowa, and coincidentally enough, their name is Cicada Killer Wasp. This is one I wish we could back up time and take the word killer out of their name, because people tend not to hear the adjective cicada killer, they just hear killer wasp. But cicada killer wasps are solitary. Each female makes her own nest. She doesn't have a colony to help her. She digs a hole in the ground anywhere from 12 to 24 inches deep, and she puts at the bottom of the hole a paralyzed cicada. So she has collected one of those cicadas that was singing in the trees in mid-afternoon, stuffed it down in the ground, laid an egg on it, and her offspring will eat the cicada. So cicada killer wasps are solitary. They're not aggressive. You can be around them without much threat of being stung. If the Postal Service refuses to bring your mail to the front door because you have these in your yard, you can treat them by putting insecticide dust into the burrow at night. But this is one that It's just such an admirable insect that how hard she works, how much she accomplishes to perpetuate her species by collecting these cicadas, putting them in the ground, laying eggs, so that her offspring have a sufficient food supply to emerge next year and repeat the process over.
All right. So they may look terribly frightening, but they're not going to hurt you unless maybe you step on it.
You step on it. You pick it up to see what it is. And, of course, the solitary wasps as a group are not aggressive. They're not defensive the way the social wasps are. People get used to knowing that paper wasps, bald-faced hornets, yellow jackets, honeybees, they sting you to protect that colony. So solitary wasps have no colony. They're not interested in protecting it. And the one or two experiences that we have had with stinging by cicada killers indicates that it is less painful than a honeybee sting. So being big doesn't mean it's going to be worse. It just means it's bigger.
All right. Back to the phones. Floyd is on the line from Weaver. Hi, Floyd.
Hello. Thank you. We have a new bug in our yard, and it seems to be eating our hibiscus. Looks like a big beetle. It's kind of grayish green with some fluorescent green on it. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that will lay eggs when we take them back in the house this winter, if that will present a problem.
Where is Weaver, Iowa?
It's down by Denmark.
Oh, I see.
Between Burlington and Fort Madison.
I tell you, you could work for Extension. You're just full of good information. That's how we roll. Okay. This is a big insect, an inch long, right?
At least it's quarter.
Okay. I believe what you're describing is called the green June beetle. And it's got that green color. It's kind of got a gold or tan-colored stripe around the outside. Green June beetle has other nicknames. It's called the fruit eater. It's called the fig beetle. But the thing is, not many people in Iowa are going to get to see this thing because it's limited to the southern and southeastern corner of the state. So you're in an area where the green June beetle has been reported in the past. We have seen this one down there occasionally. They do lay eggs in moist soil, and there will be a huge white grub developed from the eggs that this beetle lays. I doubt that that beetle's going to lay eggs in the soil of the potted plant. But if she did, it wouldn't be a big deal. But green June beetle is a spectacular insect because of its size, but it's also spectacularly destructive because it feeds on flowers and fruits.
It's not protected, so I can keep squishing them?
Yes, you can keep squishing them, as many as you can collect.
Thank you. Good day.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And again, you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Here is an email question from Terry. What's the best method and time of year to propagate a mock orange bush? My friend has one I just love because it's so fragrant.
I would say probably going out around late June or early July and taking softwood cuttings. Where you take the new growth, maybe 6 inches or so in length, and try to root that in coarse sand or perlite. The main problem is keeping it alive until it does root. And so you're going to keep the rooting medium moist, but you'll probably have to put a clear plastic bag over the container to ensure that it stays moist in there. And if it does, it should root in about 6 to 8 weeks.
And then you have a tiny twig of a plant.
Right.
Is this one readily available in the garden centers?
It definitely is, right. Yeah. So that would be the best way of doing it. It doesn't sucker, so you can't really dig up suckers like you can on lilac. So, but you can propagate it, but it's somewhat difficult.
All right. Back to the phones. Sharon is on the line in Polk City. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
What's your question?
Okay. We have a white swamp white oak. And it's probably 15, 20 feet tall. And we've got, it looks like hornets or wasps or something buzzing around the top. There are maybe 2 or 3 dozen. We don't know if they're doing anything. But on the bottom leaves, we've got the top of the leaf is kind of blistered, little white blisters. And then if you turn it over on the underside, there's little fuzzy things like a mealybug or something.
I don't think there's any connection between the two things you've described. The lower leaves have a leaf gall, and oaks okay. are notorious for leaf galls that form at the time the leaf was forming. So when that okay. leaf was a bud, a tiny wasp laid her eggs in the leaf, and I mean very, very tiny, not a stinging wasp at all. And uh-huh. that irritation caused the plant to grow with this blister on top and this little bit of fuzz on the bottom. And okay. there are hundreds of these leaf galls on different oaks. And they're not a lot of them look a whole lot alike, but the story is the same. It happened when the leaves were forming. Now, wasps or hornets in the top of the tree, but you don't find a nest. Is that what I heard?
We can't see any. Like I say, the tree is fairly tall and it's rather dense. So, you know, with the big leaves, it's kind of hard to see.
Yeah, but
I can hear them buzzing around, but you can see them. We didn't know if they were doing any harm or if they were feeding off something else. Or.
Well, wasps in general are beneficial because they feed on other insects. So wait until fall and see if you get to collect a hornet's nest from this tree.
All right, Sharon, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer more of your questions at 866-780-9100. With me, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and horticulturist Richard Giron, also of Iowa State University Extension. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. They're here to answer your questions about plants and insects. Give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Anne is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I had a question about which kind of tree to plant in a yard that has a sewer in it going through, you know, the sewer line. What we've had in the past was like an elm tree that had invaded the sewer line and then it died from Dutch elm, and then I had a soft maple, and then, of course, that lasted just a few years, and then it was, died or was destroyed in a storm. The Lion Energy Operation Relief offers lindens, a cucumber tree magnolia, or a hophorn beam, which is also an ironwood.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering which one would be the yard faces, the house faces east. It hasn't had a tree in the front yard for 20 years, and I'd like to give some shade to the house. It's a one-story, and yet I want to make sure, you know, I don't want to encourage it to get into that sewer line.
Well, I would probably choose the linden.
Okay.
It is a large tree. It is a shade tree. The trees that would be most likely to get into the sewer line would be things like silver maples and willows.
Right.
They would tend to be the worst. But I would choose a linden, a very nice tree, a good shade tree. Can get to be 40, 50 feet tall. Some of the other trees that you mentioned are quite a bit smaller in size, so I would choose that one.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Ann, thanks a lot for your call.
Bye.
Bye. Next up, we've got Gail in Iowa City. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I have a question for Richard Giron. We have a couple of plants, or I do in my garden, that I can't identify. I think one of them may be Rorissa, which I understand is a horrible invasive, but it shouldn't be in Johnson County where I live. The other plant is, and I think it's a weed, I didn't plant it, but it's been sitting there for a few years, and it's unusual looking. It has sort of strange leaves and flowers, so I've let it be there, and it hasn't been invasive or anything, but I would like to know, since I haven't any idea what it is, how one can go about identifying things like that, where you just don't know where to begin.
Well, one way is to simply dig up a plant, if you can.
Uh-huh.
Basically shake off the dirt and basically put it in dry paper toweling, put it in a uh-huh. plastic bag,
uh-huh.
and you can send that to Iowa State.
Okay.
The other approach is to take some nice, clear digital photos
uh-huh.
and take photos of the foliage,
uh-huh.
The flowers,
uh-huh.
the fruit, anything uh-huh. it has,
uh-huh.
and send those to Iowa State, and I can give you the email address.
Okay.
It would be Hortline,
Hortline.
Which is HORTLINE.
Yeah.
At.
Yeah.
IASTATE.
.edu.
.edu. And as far as mail, just address it to Horticulture Extension.
Okay.
Horticulture Building.
Uh-huh.
Iowa State University, Ames.
Okay. Do you know anything about this Rorissa?
I don't offhand.
Okay. Anyway, it seems to be a plague and comes from Europe mixed in with either daylilies or tulips or something. And it was a warning that I found on a lily grower site. Well, so maybe it's something else. Thank you very much. I will try those approaches. Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks a lot. I hope we don't have to learn a whole lot more about that weed in the future. Next, let's go to Eric in Jefferson. Hi, Eric.
Good morning, Charity.
Hi, what's your question?
I was wanting to plant a sweet cherry tree, preferably a dwarf variety, and was wanting to know a good candidate. And also, I was really hoping to plant it within a couple weeks and wondered if that was a good idea or not.
Well, as far as sweet cherries, most varieties are not reliably hardy in central and northern Iowa.
Okay.
So we're quite limited as far as what we can grow. There have been some recent introductions from Cornell University in New York, and they are much hardier than previous varieties, and I would look for those.
Okay.
Look for gold, black gold, or white gold.
Okay.
And I think most of those are self-fruitful,
okay,
so one tree would produce fruit. But look for those three, gold, black gold, or white gold.
Okay. And what about planting, say, early September? Is that a good idea?
You can, but you don't really gain much by doing it in the fall. So unless you see a bargain, maybe a sale, I might be inclined to wait and do it in the spring. So if you do it in the spring, then you have the entire growing season to take care of it, get it established, and it should do quite well.
Okay. Well, this is more of a symbolic tree than a tree looking for grapefruit. So.
Okay.
All right, Eric.
Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot for your call. I think maybe you can get both the symbolism and grapefruit.
Yes. Yes, you can.
All right. Joe is on the line next from Boone. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I've got a beetle question. I've got a beetle that defoliated about 90% of my potato plants this year. It's a gray beetle about maybe half to three-quarters of an inch long. It's got some black edging on it.
You bet.
Kind of narrow through the shoulders and a little thicker through the abdomen.
Yep.
And you know what that is?
Sure. There are several species of blister beetle. Blister beetles is also known as old-fashioned potato bug. And I think the one you're describing is called the margined blister beetle because of those stripes along the side. But there's another blister beetle called the striped blister beetle. There's a black blister beetle. I believe the one you're describing is called the margined blister beetle. Yes, they feed on all plants in that family. So we'll see them on potatoes in the garden, and we'll see them on nightshade in the fence row. Occasionally destructive, but more often just here and there we'll hear reports of them. As the name implies, they do cause blistering of tender skin. So if you're going with a mechanical control, as in, I'm going to just pick these things off and throw them away, you need to wear your gloves, and then don't be scratching the back of your neck with your gloved finger after you've been holding those beetles. That's not terribly annoying. It's not lethal to have a blister, but it can be quite painful to have these huge water blisters. The common insecticides that we use in the garden will also control them, but you need to start early and spray often. But old-fashioned potato bug or blister beetle is one that we get to talk about occasionally, but not every year. So thanks for your call.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. The two of the varieties of potatoes I planted didn't seem to be affected, but the Kennebec were completely, there wasn't a leaf left on them by the fall. So they wiped them out pretty good.
They were picky, weren't they?
Yeah, apparently. So thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot for your call. Donald, thanks for making my skin crawl.
You're welcome.
Move along to Heidi in LeClaire. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question?
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. We have a larger crop of bumblebees, those yellow jackets, that are very interested in the pollen and our raspberry bushes. But so I haven't been getting too many raspberries near them, but I think they've also found a home under some brush that we've piled up that we plan to burn, and they may have a nest there. And they're also a little bit close to our tomato plants, so I'm very nervous going out to get tomatoes now. And I'm wondering how we can manage to get some raspberries and to burn those that brush pile without, you know, killing them.
Yeah.
Is there a way to get them to move on to other property? What could we do here?
Well, it's as far as I know, relocating bumblebees is not going to be an easy thing to do. The good thing about bumblebees is they are very beneficial pollinators. Your tomato crop is benefiting from their presence there. And bumblebees have better things to do than to sting you. And bumblebees seem to be fairly docile. You can work in the garden where they are foraging. You can kind of push them aside and they won't sting you. Now, the exception is when you get close to the colony, which is usually in the ground, in a little depression, under some brush like you've described, when you get close to the colony, they may become defensive. So for that, we don't like them in high traffic areas. But if we can just ignore them for another couple of months, nature will take care of this for us. Bumblebees make annual colonies. Every year they start from scratch with a single female who produces a colony in a depression or a hole in the ground, and in the fall of the year, all of her daughters that have now produced another batch of queens, all of those daughters will freeze to death and the colony will not come back. So one approach is pick your raspberries at night, be around the bumblebees in the garden and not worry about them, avoid the woodpile until they have frozen off in the fall, then they will have done what they needed to do and you can burn the brush pile then.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Heidi. And next, let's go to Jose somewhere on I-80. Hi, Jose.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your question? Good.
Actually, I got a couple of questions. I was mentioning about a program that I listened. I'm traveling through Rhinebeck right now. I'm hauling some farm equipment. And I caught your program. And one of the questions that I have is I heard about a sweet corn that is not growing as much anymore. And it's actually a gentleman around Indiana is received it in the mail from seed. But I did not catch the second portion of the name of it.
Okay, I think that was on Morning Edition this morning.
So I missed it again.
Okay, well, you know what? We can put you on hold and find that information for you. Did you have another question?
Yes, and the other one is I have a farm in north of Croydon, Iowa, and I've had a colony of honeybees in my house. The house is an old house, and the question is, is it possible that the extension might be able to help me salvage those bees? I'm sure the whole house is probably full of honey now. And I would like to see if I can maybe salvage the honey colony out of there. And what can I do to go about doing something like that?
It'll be a lot of work, especially if they have been there a long time. And like you say, there may be honey in the walls that will attract other varmints even after the bees are gone. I think the Iowa Honey Producers Association will be a better source of information because there are beekeepers throughout the state that have banded together in this Iowa Honey Producers Association, and they offer training, they help you get started, they will tell you where to buy equipment, they are generous in providing information and advice to new beekeepers. They will also help you disinfest these honeybees because they're wild, they probably have lots of parasites and diseases. And that's going to be a treatment regime that you're going to have to do to keep that colony healthy, especially in captivity. So I would contact, I would look up Iowa Honey Producers Association online, find their contacts, and go through there. We can tell you that it's a hard job, but we're not in the position to come do it for you or even actually give you a whole lot of advice since it's not our specialty.
All right. Jose, good luck with that. And also, it was a story on All Things Considered yesterday, so you can find that on the NPR website about the corn, but it's called New England 8-Row Flint, and it's a field corn, not a sweet corn. So it's a story worth looking up. But let's move on to the next call and talk to Mike in Maquoketa. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
When walking through our lawn, our shoes get like rusty colored dust on them, and I was wondering what that was and how to get rid of it. Or
well,
it's harmful to the lawn.
It is rust. It's a fungal disease. Typically shows up in mid to late summer when the grass is no longer growing, so you don't have to mow it, but you may have warm, humid days, maybe a heavy dew at night, and so this fungus occurs. It typically doesn't destroy the grass. It's kind of annoying, obviously. And it usually goes away once the grass begins to grow again and you mow. So what you could do is, for example, you could fertilize in September and then either wait for rain or irrigate. And with the cooler temperatures, with the fertilizer, with the moisture, the grass should start to grow very quickly. You'll need to mow it and the rust goes away.
Okay, great.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks a lot for your call, Mike. And let's squeeze one more in. This is Drew on the line from Ankeny. Hi, Drew.
Good morning. My great grandparents came across from Austria and Czechoslovakia in the early 1900s. And at the home place in Eldora, where I grew up, they had apricot and pear trees, and I gorged myself, and they were wonderful. I now live in Ankeny, and I have excellent soil, and it's black dirt to about 28 inches down, and then I hit clay. I wondered if you could point me in the right direction. I would like to plant some.
Okay, as far as pears, we can grow a number of pear varieties in Iowa. What you might want to do is go on the internet and go to Iowa State University. We have a publication on fruit cultivars for Iowa. You could also Google that term, fruit cultivars for Iowa. We have a number of pears that we can grow. As far as the apricots, the best ones would be Moon Gold and Sun Gold. Those are hybrids from Minnesota, extremely hardy. The old-fashioned one is Gold Cot, and you could try that one also.
What was the last one, please?
Gold Cot.
Gold Cot.
Right, Gold Cot.
Thank you for your advice.
All right, Drew, thanks a lot for your call. And, Richard, every time you answer a question like that, I think I need more land.
So, we all do.
Exactly. So many good things to grow. Richard Giron, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron, ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. Thank you, Donald.
Thank you, Charity. Always a pleasure.
And, of course, we'll be back with Horticulture Day next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Sean McLean. You can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up Monday on the show, we're going to talk about art inspired by nature and disease. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.